if we don't learn from history, we're like doomed to repeat it. And I hope sincerely that we are learning every single time and getting better and smarter about this stuff. Like parachain auction slots. So first of all, it just like limited innovation, right? You couldn't have a permissionlessly like tap into the economic security of Polkadot. They would have one every 3 weeks. It was this massive event. Like I think Akala had like $1.3 billion of like DOT locked up. And then it was locked up for like 2 years, right? I mean, like holy inefficiency of like market structure, right? Just like, wow, this is crazy. The like some of them like a year later went for $55,000.
Nuts.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the Wormhole Foundation. If you are a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That's why we are super pumped to have partnered with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. The Wormhole Protocol connects over 30 blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Solana, Sui, Ethereum, Layer 2s, and more. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. You can claim that by just going down into the show notes and clicking on the link. All right, guys, on with the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Swell, a team leading the restaking future with their liquid restaking token rSweep. Now, I've talked about liquid restaking on this program before. I think it is going to be a massive tectonic shift for Ethereum, and I am super, super excited about it, and I like the Swell team a lot. Goes without saying, do your own research. This is not financial advice. You guys all know the drill. Again, I like this team, and if you stick around, I'm going to describe how you can restake your ETH in Swell, earn pearls, eigenlayer points, and a whole bunch of future rewards. So thank you very much for Swell for making this episode possible. Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, if you are a listener of Bell Curve, you know that MEV is a massive problem, which is why we are so pumped to partner up with Flood on this season. Flood is the only gasless and MEV-free aggregator that not only gets you the best execution, but also gives you back all the extra surplus that you create every single time you swap. Now, this is relevant for both swappers and developers, but you're going to be hearing all about them later in the program. So for now, thank you, Flood, and back to the show.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another roundup edition of Bell Curve. You got Miles today. Miles, welcome. And special guest, new to the show, Jim Perillo of Figment Cap. Guys, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
excited to have you, Jim.
I love the pudgy in the back there, Jim.
Thank you.
Glad we got that in shot.
Welcome to the New York Figment Capital office. I'm the GP of Figment Capital. Been working with Miles for a little while, and got to know Mike at ETH Denver, and then we're all in New York City, and so got to grab drinks. You've got the Pudgy Penguin behind us, which is an NFT that our CFO and COO owns. Funny story behind that. We've got some Initia stickers back here. We've got some Bad Kids on the walls for you Bad Kid people. So it's a fun office. We believe in office culture. Everyone's here. Everyone works out of the office every day. It's good times.
We love a CFO that is comfortable with Pudgy Penguins. That is the sign of a flexible CFO, more so than anything.
He lets us get away with a lot of things. Like he's responsible in all the right ways and flexible in all the best ways.
That's amazing. That's a good one too. It's got a little Santa cap. I don't know the rarity of all the pudgies, but it's been a tough month for pudgies. Actually, they were down like 50%, something like that, in the last month. So, hanging on by a thread. But what are you gonna do? Either up, actually, I saw in the last couple hours. So that's good.
Everyone's rotating into Geo Bowden, rotating their profits into Geo Bowden,
dude. So I'm talking to you. And by the way, Vance and Michael, they're both flying back. They were with us in London. I've been in London for the last 3 days at Das London, which was a blast for the most part. You would be shocked at the amount of times that meme coins got referenced on like the main stage of this all institutional conference and it's not just like the degens that like snuck their way in. It was like Franklin Templeton was talking about these things like in a positive way. You know, this wasn't just like, oh, wrote speculation, yada, yada. there were a lot of positive framings around these meme coins in a very institutional crowd. So that was interesting to me.
I understand. Like, we don't talk too much about them publicly. Some funds don't. I'm curious, like, what was the positive framing? Like, how were they like looking at them and thinking about them? How's TradFi thinking about meme coins?
I think the positive framing basically is that it encourages adoption. And this is where there's a lot of over intellectualization going on around meme coins, I think, writ large. I think whenever you start to see the, you know, 20 thread, you know, think boy pieces from the VCs, it's like, you should probably just sell whatever they're talking about. And I think we're reaching that with the meme coins, like tokenization of culture. Okay. But one thing that I've thought about a little bit on this whole, like, this always comes up, right? Speculation versus real world use cases. I think finance, you know, when you're building financial product, the alchemy that actually goes into that is speculation. And that speculation can actually lead to real products that are extremely useful. Great example of that is the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That is not an animal that exists in the wild. The only reason why it's possible for banks to offer you a 30-year fixed rate mortgage is because there's a bunch of degens out there that want to take levered bets on interest rates in this really deep and liquid market of interest rate swaps. So it's never felt totally true to me, these people that are against speculation, it's the work of the devil. And it's never really felt great to me to be like, yeah, we're just building an online casino here. I kind of hate both of those framings. I think when it comes to financial applications, some amount of speculation is required to make real products. And I don't know, I sort of just loosely lump meme coins somewhere into that conversation. That's how I look at it.
I mean, like, meme coins are, you know, essentially ICOs without the ICO, right? So like, you didn't have to put the deck together. You didn't have to like scam a bunch of people. Like, everyone kind of knows what they're getting into on day one. And like, it's gambling. It's like on-chain gambling. It's on-chain, like, sometimes they become communities, sometimes they don't. It's fun. People should do it. I'm going to like quote you in like, the over intellectualization of meme coins is like a hilarious thing to think about. Because when you're on chain and you're looking for them, it's anything but intellectual at all. Exactly. But it's fun. It's good. It's like and there's a ton of coins that come on, and a lot of them are launching right now on Solana, and it's the trading pair of Sol, right? And like, yeah, it does create a bit of like a base, like a bigger base for like Sol to be a trading pair, a major trading pair on its own chain. People aren't rotating into like stable coins when they sell out of these, like, right? They're rotating back into Sol. I assume that has very much helped the price of Sol. But it maybe also comes with, like, you know, we talked about this a little bit before, like, violent delights come with like violent ends. And like, you start to see like these crazy ticks up, and you're going to see like crazy ticks down, because like, the people stop, you know, when meme coins go down, you sell into Sol. And then like, when some point people start taking profits into Sol or something, like, maybe it impacts the price. We haven't looked too much into it, but like, there's a ton of shit coins on Ethereum.
Yeah. Okay. Jim and Miles, let me get your guys' take on something about this. So, talking about pudgies, I do think that meme coins are starting to fulfill at least one of the reasons why I was really bullish on NFTs going into this year. So if you look at some of these big airdrops that were, you know, this is the first time I feel like that I've seen this. Dimension is a really good example of this, that gave large airdrop allocations to pudgy holders or bad kids, et cetera. And the idea is like, look, we know that we're getting sibled here. So we might as well, if we're looking out into the universe of crypto users and we're looking for communities that are have some form of identification, right, and are wealthy and are going to be good potential customers that I don't already have. Well, these NFT collections actually kind of look like that. And I don't know if this is true, so someone fact check me on this, but I saw that some crazy percentage of Pudgy holders actually ended up just staking their Dimension airdrop. So in my mind, that was one of the big reasons why you wanted to hold an NFT. Like, you're probably going to get more of these free airdrops as you get a bunch of TGEs coming up in the next couple months. But I think meme coins are starting to eat into some of the market share of NFTs, and the other probably larger market for NFTs is just all coins with pictures. I think that's a very real part of it. And I actually heard some speculation at this conference this week that maybe projects would actually start airdropping to meme coin holders. And I am a little bit conflicted about this. I you know, from one sense, it probably is a really great way. It solves a lot of the problems that we were just talking about in terms of, you know, Sybil resistance, all that kind of stuff. It's probably a good way to get wider distribution and very retail participation for your airdrop. On the other hand, I'm imagining the type of person that is holding these meme coins and thinking, do I really want that? You know, are these the best people that I could have on my cap table, so to speak? You know, maybe not. I'm not 100% sure.
They're crypto users. They're probably crypto native, most of them. I mean, there's maybe a world there where, like, if you're where it could make a ton of sense, right? Like, if it's people that you want using your product, like, who else is like in the gutters, like looking up
Geoboat?
At the very best, it's Geoboat. Like, you know, and others, but like, it's probably
already not your grandpa's meme coin now. It's so bogus.
And it's better than Sybil Farmers, right? And it's different.
Right.
And like, it will distract from, you know, inevitably, like, people who are upset about whatever allocation they got. And yeah, I think these ways, like, to think about targeting on airdrops are kind of fun. We talked about even like looking at podcast audiences. You know, how about, it's a bit self-serving, yes. But I think that's pretty targeted as well. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves.
We were talking to this one like restaking protocol, and they had mentioned that they were thinking about like using restaking for not just for security, but more for like, you know, you like lock up tokens and maybe you get like whitelisted for like some, I can't believe I'm saying this, like meme coin presale or something like that, right? But like essentially, like, you know, restaking can be maybe used in different ways than like what people are thinking about. Like, it actually is like decentralized trust in a different way, where it's like trust, like that you're gonna lock up this token. It's this opportunity cost that you, let's assume it's ETH or SOL or something. Like, the opportunity cost is like, you know, you are gonna give this up in order to like access something for a period of time. I don't know whether that needs to be restaked or not, but like essentially, it's like, it is an interesting way of thinking about like, yeah, maybe also transitions us into something other than meme coins, but like,
it's like every panel for the last 3 days, like, the institutionalization of market structure, 2 minutes in talking about meme coins. But that is probably a good segue here, Jim, because we initially, what we wanted to do with this conversation is have a little bit of an update on the restaking ecosystem in general. And I know the two of you are just extremely, extremely deep into this ecosystem, and it feels pretty timely. You know, I think we're having some of the large LRTs that are launching pretty soon. EtherFi being in that bucket, there's over $10 billion worth of capital that has migrated to Eigenlayer. Looks like that's going to be up only. And there are some, you know, rumors of new challengers in the restaking arena outside of Eigenlayer. And overall, the space just really feels like it is heating up. And I wanted to actually, before we get into some of the nitty gritty specifics around Eigenlayer, wanted to talk to the two of you because you've both been very involved in the progenitor of shared security on Cosmos, right? Which is interchain security. And I think, you know, Miles, you and I in our app chain season, we talked about how Ethereum might be a little bit guilty of ignoring some of the lessons of Cosmos, namely interoperability, right? As it adopted its app chain sort of roadmap. And I would love to get a sense from the two of you about some of the lessons that you learned from the shared security side of Cosmos back in the early days and see what may or may not be applicable to Eigenlayer today.
Yeah, and maybe I'll just start off by kind of giving the two forms of shared security that are either in production or in development in Cosmos. And then we can kind of compare them to Eigenlayer. I mean, then we can talk about what's worked and what hasn't maybe within those early versions, right? And so the first form is what you mentioned is interchain security or replicated security. And the first version of replicated security was implemented on the Cosmos hub. And with V1 of replicated security, if governance approves a new consumer chain, the entire validator set of the Cosmos hub and all of the economic stake behind that is then, you know, restaked and now operating. So the validator is now operating a new chain, and all of the economic stake is restaked to that chain. Mesh security is kind of on the other end of the spectrum, where it is purely the restaking of economic security. So let's say I am on Osmosis. I've delegated to a validator on Osmosis, say Figment. And Osmosis enters a mesh agreement with another Cosmos chain. Let's call it Axelar. I'm purely taking the economic, you know, value of my stake and redelegating that to a validator of my choice on the other chain. And these, with mesh security, it can be bilateral. So meaning like these two chains can secure each other, or it can be just one direction. So a provider chain providing economic security to a consumer chain. And maybe compare that to, and maybe I'll also say that more recently, there is a V2 of interchain security called partial set replicated security. And with this, it is, okay, the Cosmos Hub has a new consumer chain. It's not going to make all of the validator set opt in to running a validator for this new chain. Validators can opt in basically on their own if they think it's, you know, they can be economically profitable. And I think, Jim, I'll let you speak to like why that makes a lot of sense based off of V1. But quickly, just to compare to EigenLayer, it's kind of a mix, right? It is opt-in from the validator level and opt-in from the staker level, right? And maybe the one difference is, as a staker, you are delegating to an operator, and then basically you let the operator decide which AVSs it's going to support. And it's actually going to run the hardware software, right, of those AVSs. And so it's a little bit of it's a mix of both, all right? ICS V1 would never work on Ethereum because you would never get, right, all of these validators. It's not an active set of just 150, right? It's thousands. And so maybe I'll pause there. And then Jim, you've been very close to ICS V1. You've written about, okay, what can we learn from it? And maybe you can speak to a few of the lessons there that I think we are thinking about a lot as we're looking at EigenLayer in its early stages.
Yeah, Miles, you've been like really like instrumental, and I think in like kind of like educating a lot of folks on like the EigenLayer side of like what AVSs are going to need to do. And so the AVS equivalent in Cosmos, as you mentioned, is consumer chains. They're consuming security and like presumably paying some sort of like reward or some sort of like rent or something, lease payments to the Cosmos Hub, and in the form of like Atom stakers. So they'll receive some revenue from that, or some additional like payments for that. ICS has been like, I was really excited about ICS when it was first announced. It was part of like the Atom 2.0 white paper. It was like the part that I was like actually the most interested in. We've seen shared security in like multiple levels, right? Like actually like Polkadot and parachain auctions is probably the first like real big example of like what shared security can look like, you know, where like essentially the more DOT that you have, you'll win an opportunity to be like part of the shared security of like the Polkadot network. There's a single like kind of relay or a collator that helps to like transmit blocks to the Polkadot relay chain. And like in exchange for like these like massive amounts of DOT that were locked up, especially initially, these teams would like distribute it kind of in the form of emissions. It's like slightly different, right? It's like sort of payment for this, but you would like issue tokens to DOT token holders. DOT token holders on the flip side were not staking their DOT, right? Like you didn't like, it wasn't a liquid staking token. So you were actually, there was an opportunity cost, right? You thought that like the yield that you were going to receive, or like the inflation or whatever you want to call it, emissions that you were going to receive from this parachain, 1-to-1, like maybe not 1-to-1, sometimes 20-to-1, sometimes 100-to-1, was going to be more valuable than like just staking your DOT. And the crazy thing about parachain, like parachain auctions, like great lesson learned, right? Like if we don't learn from history, we're like doomed to repeat it. And I hope sincerely that we are learning every single time and getting better and smarter about this stuff. Like parachain auction slots, like first of all, the very first one was like at the time of DOT. To win a slot, right? Because like, there was like a slot auction every 3 weeks. So first of all, it just like limited innovation, right? You couldn't have a permissionlessly like tap into the economic security of Polkadot. They would have one every 3 weeks. It was this massive event. Like I think Akala had like $1.3 billion of like DOT locked up. And then it was locked up for like 2 years, right? I mean, like holy inefficiency of like market structure, right? Just like, wow, this is crazy. Some of them like a year later went for $55,000.
Nuts. I think Miles and I both ate Dakala, actually, and I have no idea what even happened to that.
We might have some dot like that's now unlocked from the last.
It might cycle. Still be there.
I forgot about it. Anyways, yeah. Go ahead.
And so there would be these like, so just like the market was like super early, like and very nascent, and like it really kind of stifled innovation at a point in time where like Polkadot possibly could have had like a bunch of parachains on it. It could have been like the shared security network and like layer, and like a lot of these like parachains look like L2s. So, you know, a couple of years pass by and Cosmos Hub comes in and says like, hey, we want to do this like shared security protocol. We're going to call it ICS. Jay Kwan actually had written a GitHub, which is relatively legible to an extent, like in 2021. So he'd been thinking about this for a really long time. And he talks about V1, he talks about V2, and he actually talks about mesh security too, which he calls Sunny's version, interestingly enough. And there's some like pretty good insights in there. The benefits of consumer chains are, you know, we can talk about the benefits and we can talk about like some of the costs and some of the challenges there. I wrote this like crazy article about it. And I was like, this is like very relevant because what I'm noticing is that like people are kind of staying in their own lanes. Like maybe Solana people sometimes stay in their Solana lane. Maybe Ethereum people sometimes stay in their Ethereum lane. Maybe Cosmos people are staying in their Cosmos lane. And we're launching this like Eigenlayer is launching on Ethereum and like just reaching out to some folks and being like, hey, are you paying attention to what's happening on replicated security right now? Because like you have test in prod right now. Like you have like a real live version of shared security. And you, if you just pay attention a little bit, you'll see the pain points. You'll see what's like not working over there right now and what they're going to have to try to fix. And you can actually like not repeat those mistakes. We don't have to learn those mistakes over again, right? Over in Ethereum. So it's been really interesting.
That's just such a critical point. I love that you said that because you hear that very often. There's this pretty predominant take in crypto, which is, look, there are too many things going on. I can only focus in my own lane and I want to stay in this ecosystem. And I just think if you do that, if you look across all these ecosystems, I mean, there's so much design convergence. Miles, you and I have talked, that was basically the thesis of the Cosmos season. But you see, we're going to talk a little bit about Solana L2s later as well. You're seeing Bitcoin L2s like Celestia is starting to look very similar to Ethereum. And like all these different roadmaps are converging. And I think it'd be really silly to not look at the lessons that folks have learned on other chains in the past. Just could not plus one that attitude more. Totally agree with it.
I agree. And maybe to double click on like, what are some qualities that are common qualities between say like Polkadot parachains and ICS V1 that we can identify as, okay, this was less than ideal. Like this should be improved upon. And to me, the two are like, when you have an overly rigid structure, and I think that is reflected by like the I think what Jim alluded to with the parachain auctions and kind of a set schedule. I think the second piece is, you know, this whole idea of like all these validators are not created equal, right? There are definitely economies of scales within the validator industry, like broadly, right? And, you know, I think there is a world where if you were to say like combine, let's say partial set security with mesh security, you could get the best of both worlds where you could have the operators that are, you know, can profitably opt in to run these chains. And then operators that don't are able to, you know, if you're delegating to one of them at the bottom of the set, that doesn't mean you have to like miss out on this extra yield. You should be able to use mesh security to delegate your stake to one of the operators that is opted in, right? What other big ones are there, Jim? I feel like
there's some like super basic things. Like I think when it came to replicated security, like onboarding process, like a lot of it is just like standards and processes. Like how do you do this? And how do you do this in a thoughtful way? And like, what are the expectations and managing expectations, right? Like we have $11 billion of ETH like pre-staked on Eigenlayer right now. Like we argue a little bit about what's supply and what's demand, but like the question is like whether there's enough ABSs that even need this or can actually incentivize this in like a proper way that like doesn't mean that Eigenlayer is somehow like subsidizing like people to continue to restake their ETH. In Cosmos, because of the replicated security model, like you have 180 validators on Cosmos Hub and they're forced to support any consumer chain that launches, right? So that's $4 billion of economic security, like staked Atom, right? And when you look at the two consumer chains that exist today, you have Neutron and you have Stride, right? No judgment on the projects or the teams or anything like that. Like talking with like a collective friend of ours, like Xerox Crane, he'd say like, it's very hard to incentivize a big thing with a little thing, right? And so like the questions of managing expectations, everyone's sort of like vibing into the first couple consumer chains and saying like, yeah, let's just do this. This is going to be a great experiment. This is going to be great for everyone. And nobody really looked at like the proposal standards, like what do we expect like to be a good amount of like actual compensation and like for this economic security, for this validator set, like are validators being properly compensated? Are some running at a loss? What is like the fee split? What is the yield split? Like is all of the staking rewards, is it going to Cosmos Hub, Atom Stakers? Is some of like, are you going to be able to do dual staking? These are L1s. Will you be able to stake like your Stride token or your Neutron token? What's the fee split? And we started to see some of these, and like people were just like, there was no guidance, right? And so like Neutron like essentially had to figure it out on their own. And they had to like put the first proposal together like kind of on their own. And they threw out some numbers. They were like, I think it's like somewhere around like, we're going to give 25% of like transaction fees. We're going to give like 50% of MEV. And we're not going to have any inflation, right? And so, okay, that might work if like, you know, but like what is the value of Neutron's token and how much transaction fees are we really, like what kind of transactions are we actually looking at here in volume? And, you know, like you start running the numbers and I ran the numbers and I was trying to like explain the numbers to some people. And I was like, yo, like this is, you know, no offense, this is like terrible. For like Atom Stakers, like, and these validators, especially like the validators were running one network. Now they're running two validators. You can tell me it's easy. You can tell me it's hard to run a validator on Cosmos Hub or Cosmos. I don't care. It still costs money. And like the revenue was like for one Atom at $10, like you can expect somewhere around like fractions of a penny, for one Atom staked. Right. And so you're just like, who is making money on this? Like who is actually like incentivized to actually do this and to support this and to like make sure that like Neutron doesn't go down or that Neutron is like supported. Like the operators are not incentivized. Telling them that they're already getting paid for in Atom tokens is like not like something that anyone wants to hear. Like, hey, I'll give you twice the work. Oh, you're going to work 80 hours this week. I'm going to keep paying you the same salary going forward is like not a great incentive model. It doesn't really align the interests of like the stakers, the consumer chain, the producer chain, and like also the operators that are actually like trying to run businesses on this. It's just like kind of unfortunately, like probably not enough.
And yeah. It was more like set it and kind of forget it. That was the other issue. There was no, and of course the price of these, of the reward tokens could fluctuate a ton, right? We saw, you know, Stride has like 10x'd in the past 6 months, right? That probably should also be able to, you know, be factored into these things, right? It like the amount that one of these projects pays out, you know, should not be like extraordinarily unprofitable for everybody, you know, in the bear markets and then maybe too profitable in the bull markets. And I think the other point you made there is that to me, I think the operators get the kind of a raw deal. And I am starting to see this in Eigenlayer as well, that I don't think enough of the AVS side or the restaker, the depositor size, are actually thinking about like the constraints of the operators, because the difference of taking on additional slashing risk is very different than running new hardware and having like humans, right, running, like operating these networks. The cost is linear, right, for operators as they take on more and more, but the cost is not, you know, it's hard to quantify like the cost, you know, to stakers, right? If it's just additional slashing risk, and really the only way that operators are paid are via commission fee, right? So it's usually 5 or 10%, and I think that should be either a floating commission rate or that should be like separated out entirely, right? I think you can predict how much operators, you know, it's going to cost operators to run these networks, and you can make sure that they're profitable. And that can be like a totally separate payment stream and like consideration than how much do I need, you know, to pay depositors in terms of, or stakers in terms of yield uplift, right, for them to take this on.
Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to the title sponsor of this season of Bell Curve, the Wormhole Foundation. Now, if you are an on-chain user, which I bet you are, if you're listening to Belcurve, you know that the cross-chain experience in crypto still sucks. Let's just call a spade. We talk about it on this program all the time. Interop is still a big problem, which is why we specifically wanted to team up with the Wormhole Foundation. They are a decentralized interop platform that powers multi-chain applications and bridges. So that could be anything from DeFi to NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. So if you are a developer and you're building cross-chain assets, apps, or data, or anything like that, I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of this episode and go check out to see what you can build on Wormhole. And Wormhole, first of all, this is a fun team. They did something really cool with us. You can actually go and click the link at the bottom of the screen, which is going to send you to a landing page where you can claim your own unique Wormhole NFT. So we're doing this with me, and we're doing this with Jason, my co-founder. So help a brother out. It's a super cool NFT, I promise. Go click the link at the bottom of this episode and fill out your POAP, get your free NFT. And if you're a dev, head over to Wormhole and check out to see what cool cross-chain stuff you can build. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Swell, a liquid restaking protocol and the issuer of the rSweep liquid restaking token. Now, if you're a listener of Belcurve, you know that I am just so fascinated by restaking and liquid restaking. I think it is going to be one of the most important trends in Ethereum, and I am really excited for the benefit that it unlocks both users and also Ethereum, the protocol itself. Now, disclaimer, whenever there's yield involved in a product, do your own research. This is not financial advice. You guys know the drill, but Swell is a great team. They have a non-custodial product, and they are mission-driven on giving you the best liquid staking experience. If you take one benefit away from using liquid restaking, make it be capital efficiency. Now you can earn passive yield from Ethereum. You can earn yield from multiple actively validated services that stack on top of that. And then you can still use rSweep as collateral in DeFi. And because I know y'all are a bunch of degens, there's a points angle here as well. But in Swell, we call them pearls. So pearls equal points. And if you stake your ETH with Swell, you can earn pearls and future Eigenlayer rewards. And when there's a token generation event, you can swap your pearls for Swell tokens. Head over, click the link at the bottom of this episode. Again, just pause what you're doing right now. Go click the link at the bottom of this episode. Check out Swell. Thank you later. Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, Flood is the perfect partner for this episode on the multi-chain future because Flood is solving so many of the issues that we're going to be talking about this season. And this is relevant for both traders and devs. So if you are a trader, you should definitely head over to FloodSwap and start trading because they solve three massive problems. One, gasless trading, no more pesky trading fees. Two, you don't have to worry about getting front run, MEV free. And then three, they have excellent order routing so that you know that you are getting the best price. So head over to FloodSwap and click the link in the bottom of the show notes. We're going to send you right there. For the devs out there, you can leverage Flood's flexible hooks, allowing you to make swapping a first-class primitive by adding custom order types like TWAPs. Or if you're a wallet builder or something like that, you can actually build your own order flow auction in and start recapturing a bunch of that MEV. If you want to reach out to them, go to devs@flood.bid or just jump right in the Discord. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Appreciate you, Flood.
So, well, let me try to, because I want to zoom out here and just explain for the audience as well. Like, I think what we're talking about here is, okay, everyone's very excited. There have been multiple iterations of shared security by Polkadot, Interchain Security and Cosmos. Now the newest one is Eigenlayer. And I think what you guys are both describing is that everyone thinks that that's an extremely good idea in principle, but the actual details matter. And especially the economics have not been very well thought out. And whether or not this is a good deal ultimately for the sort of the supply side of this. And it seems this is kind of what we're seeing right in Eigenlayer, that we've seen a ton of money ETH stakers pour in. We can speculate as to why that is. It probably they're chasing doing what the degens are doing and try to farm the Eigen airdrop, right, or various other types of airdrops, so we can question how healthy that incentivization is from the marketplace itself, which is a huge factor here. But it might just, like, maybe just to put a bow on the lessons from the ICS part of it, like, one thing that I would also add is, well, I would just ask you guys, do you think Interchain Security as it exists in Cosmos today is successful or not? Because one of the challenges that I've also thought of, I think you guys have, like, loosely alluded to this, but there's also an adverse selection problem when it comes to consumer chains as well. I think that's not, it's like Stride and Neutron are both phenomenal projects, but I'm not sure they really did it for the economic side of things, right? They kind of did it. There's like a loose alignment cultural reason that both Neutron and Stride did this that was more a business strategy thing. So I don't know. I guess let's put a bow on the, like, lessons part before we kind of move more deeply into Eigenlayer and get
I can give a super quick thing. I think they succeeded on the tech, and you know, V1 is like a fine V1. V2 they've shipped very fast. I think where they've, you know, it's fallen short is, to your point, like the non-technical stuff, like just having the restaking pipes itself does not mean success. There's the qualities of like the Atom token in terms of market cap, liquidity, volatility, you know, the closer you are to something like ETH in terms of all of those things, the better. And obviously Atom is very far away from that. And then there is kind of a branding alignment sort of aspect to it that I think, has also been kind of a headwind for the hub, but Jim, curious to hear your take.
Yeah, I think all of those things are accurate. I mean, the other thing I'd say along alignment, especially with Cosmos Hub, is that it's like this application specific blockchain and they have liquidity, right? They have Atom tokens. And one of the things that's been really interesting is like, there is actually like business partnerships that can be spurred from this, right? Like there is a treasury, and that treasury can be used to like deposit Atom into AMMs, right? That Atom can be used through governance proposals to liquid stake on Stride, and then to like provide a liquidity pool between like Atom and staked Atom, ST Atom. And like, so there are ways in which like you say, hey, this is like kind of like a rising tide lifts all boats sort of scenario that like can be very much more played into. It requires like governance to be like thoughtful and like actually like positive in certain ways. And like one last thing I would say is that like one thing I did, which like I've really don't recommend anyone doing unless they like love being like just shit on generally, is sorry for swearing. It's like I posted this article about like the challenges and the benefits of to ICS and replicated security. Then what I decided to do was like, here are how to fix it. And rather than write an article about that, I posted it on the Cosmos forum. You have to love self pain and the inflicted pain in order to do something like that. So like, it was an interesting experience. I probably won't do it again, but like I try to come up with like solutions to these problems and thought like that there are like actual real intangible benefits that can exist, but like you have to kind of put in the planning work too. It's not just about onboarding. It's also about what the offboarding standards look like and like what are the processes by which like people get onboarded and offboarded, and we evaluate whether something is successful or unsuccessful. When do we cut ties, right? When do we dock our boat to it? Like, so I think it's like really an interesting, like there's a lot of learning lessons, and I'm excited to like talk a little bit more about what Eigen's doing.
Me too. Like, can we get into the weeds of Eigenlayer? So obviously there's been an enormous amount of demand from the depositor standpoint. I don't even know what the latest numbers are. I keep saying 10 billion. I know it crossed 10 billion in deposits at one point, probably is higher than that now. What I would be curious to understand is, what does the AVS side of the marketplace look like? You know, when we were at Miles, I know you organized a phenomenal event, you know, Club AVS at ETH Denver. And just speaking to, I don't know how accurate these numbers are, but just talking to some folks, and there are a bunch of AVSs there, but you know, my sense of the size of that market wasn't hundreds of protocols. It was, you know, probably sub 30 sub 30 AVSs, and quality was probably much lower than even that. And I also think in terms of ultimately what's driving this, my sense, you know, Jim, you're maybe alluding at the beginning that, not everything is about the economic security value proposition here, but you know, even when you're talking about something like there are two other elements, which is one, this sort of mushy question of alignment, ecosystem alignment, and then I also think there's probably an element here of maybe buying into a narrative. We saw some of this where some of the stranded L1s that didn't necessarily have product market fit, back when there was a new L2 launching every day. I guess there still is a new L2 launching every day, but you know, we're rebranding from, you know, mid-tier L1 into the roll-up roadmap for Ethereum. And it feels like some of the stuff that's going on in the AVS and restaking world is, we're not just some middleware solution, we're an AVS, you know, jazz fingers, that kind of thing. So give us a sense, though, you know, being a little bit more boots on the ground of what the demand side of this shared security marketplace looks like.
Yeah, I think that number is probably pretty on. I think there's probably 10, you know, to 15 large, you could call them large projects, like well-funded projects that will have, you know, high market caps. And then there's, you know, kind of a long tail in development that absolutely could, you know, be in the same boat in a few months. And on the AVS side, I mean, the rubber is starting to hit the road in terms of, okay, how much are we going to pay? Like, what do we actually want here? Do we want this like permissionless, you know, operator set? No, like that's a little scary out of the gate. So we want to pick operators that we know, we like, we can get on the phone with. And then how much do we want to pay? It's kind of reminds me of where ICS V1 was at beforehand. It was like, let's just throw stuff at the wall. And that's okay. Like that is what I think we all expected. And I think what's interesting is that we're starting to see some of the first actual like announcements of LRTs, you know, committing capital to AVSs now. And I think that, you know, all those negotiations are kind of happening off chain right now. And what's kind of funny to me is that, like, you know, we'll say like, okay, we are committing $1 billion, you know, across of economic security across, you know, maybe this LRT or like two or three LRTs. You know, we've got the guaranteed that we'll have this for say like at least 6 months, right? We don't want more than this number. We don't want less than this number. And so we need you guys to like make sure that this is kind of a siphoned off capital, right? So new deposits are not, you know, coming towards our pooled security. Because the reason for that quickly is just, you know, if you have unlimited capital come in, the yield is diluted for everybody. And then, you know, you probably have a lot of volatility in terms of people withdrawing. And what's kind of interesting is that, you know, there's nothing actually on chain to enforce these SLAs, these requirements. And so it's like, okay, well, what if there's some, you know, black swan event and there's a huge withdrawal, right? That all these things just kind of go away, right? And then I think from the really interesting one is these duration requirements that I think make sense. Like if I was an AVS, I would want to know, okay, this is locked in for this much time and I don't have to worry about it again. Like we set our economics and we can forget it. But from the LRT or any sort of like, you know, depositor side, that it ends up with a very different sort of set of dynamics than say like what you do when you deposit into an LST, right? There's going to be now like a lot of complexity in terms of balance sheet management for LRTs. Let's say, how do you support withdrawals, right? If like half of your, you know, deposits are technically locked up according to these agreements, and maybe those agreements eventually come on chain, right? So they're actually enforced, and then what do you do, right? So yeah, those are some of the observations in the early days. Maybe the last one is that, you know, I think there's $11 billion of deposits. A lot of it is in LRTs, and AVSs for the most part are looking at, okay, the easiest way to like do this is to have, I want a permissioned operator set to start off with. And the easiest way to get to a set of like, you know, high quality operators and a ton of capital is to go to LRTs. And so, yeah, right now it's, I think AVSs are mainly working with LRTs as the fastest way to get this economic security and the operators they want. And in general, the, you know, the pricing power, the leverage right now is with the AVS side because there's $11 billion of deposits and, you know, the yield uplift on that $11 billion is based off of what AVSs are willing to pay. And there's, you know, relatively low number of super high quality AVSs. And so they have all the leverage at this point. And I think that makes sense. It's going to change too, because I mean, Jim, you remember like Stride and Neutron had the leverage in those conversations because this was really the new big thing for the hub and they needed to get started. Right. So yeah. I'll pause there, but curious to hear your reaction.
Yeah, like I think one of the more interesting things to think about is like, why are LRTs like announcing these partnerships, right? And why are AVSs going to these LRTs? And when you think about like maybe three categories of like restakers right now on Ethereum, you probably have three groups, right? You have retail, you have like whales that are throwing $250 million in a single transaction who have probably their own incentives. And then you have LRTs, right? And if you're an AVS developer right now and you're trying to get like economic security for and restaked ETH, like kind of like delegated, let's say, I know it's pooled security initially, but like delegated to your AVS so that you can launch on day one when EigenLayer launches, or like week one when EigenLayer launches. Like, you cannot talk to retail like as a collective, right? Like, there's no concentration of like ETH that you can get restaked and committed to you in any sort of meaningful way. Like, sure, you can go talk to like a whale if you think that that's like a better idea, or funds that have like a ton of ETH if you think that's a better idea. But like, presumably the one place that you can go and whose business it is to like have an old restaked ETH and to actually figure out places and AVSs to like delegate it to are LRTs, right? So like, in some ways, it's like just the natural way that like, if this thing is like the cold start problem of like, how do I start and get economic security and ETH restaked to my protocol? Like, I guess I'm going to have to go to where like the biggest pool is that like has like a single decision maker or like a team of decision makers that can actually make a decision, say, yeah, we'll support you on day one. So we actually, there's a ton of questions about like, I don't know whether AVSs are asking LRTs any of these questions. There's a lot of the ones that you mentioned, Miles. I don't know whether LRTs are asking AVSs any of these questions, because there's like a ton of stuff, right? Like, I think number one is like you touched on the validator or the operators. You know, one interesting thing and insight that we get at Figment Capital is that like, you know, we are closely connected with Figment, the proof of stake infrastructure provider. We're separate, but we're connected with them and we talk to them quite frequently. And one of the areas I think has kind of gone like, it's actually one of the more interesting things about replicated security V1, which is that it forced all the validators to join on day one, right? You couldn't like opt out. And when you're forced in, I have to do this. I can't like, I'm not making a decision. The operator is not making a decision to like, to subject or to like expose like the staked assets to these other slashing conditions that other operators didn't. Right. Once you start going down this road where like operators are making decisions on behalf of like their restakers, you look a lot like a fiduciary, right? Like, you're entering into, you're adding risk to like ETH that's been staked to you. Like, these are not what they signed up for. Maybe initially, maybe you start going a little bit more long tail because the yield looks better. It's a little riskier of an AVS or protocol. And so when you give validators, especially institutional validators, the option to opt in, a lot of them are not going to take it. And so what wound up happening, which is really interesting, is that like, you have these AVSs that are looking for like, hey, we're going to run testnet. Also, like, what else do LRTs offer, right? Like, AVS are like, we're going to run testnet. And maybe one of the questions that, and then we're going to go to operators like we would in another like pseudo network. And they would say like, hey, we're going to run testnet. Would you like to like join and participate? We're going to be an AVS on EigenLayer. And the operator's saying, don't talk to me. Like, we're just validators as a service. We're just like a validation as a service here. You got to go talk to like our boss. And our boss in this case, because like, we're not going to make any of these decisions ourselves. We don't want to be held liable for any of the decisions that we make. We're not going to like essentially put our reputation up like with some of these AVSs. Is like, then all of a sudden what you're doing is like, you're going to go speak to the LRTs. Like, we're going to contract with the LRTs. The LRTs are going to tell us where to go. They're going to tell us when to go there. And we will like, so like, there's sort of this weird dynamic right now, especially before anything has launched, right? Once things launch, it gets different, I think.
That's how you stay a service provider, right? And not a fiduciary. Is you are, you know, working for the LRT. Governance of the LRT is really making those decisions. And that is like a weird, subtle difference that I think is huge, right? Interesting. Sorry, so, Mike, go for it.
No, I want to move us into the LRT part of this discussion. And just for folks who might be a little bit less in the weeds than the two of you, is like, I think what we're talking about is a legal liability for in the Cosmos case, where you were just, everyone was opt in, you know, basically, if you want to be this participant in the network, you have to do this, as opposed to when an operator starts to make a choice about which service it's going to participate in, and essentially constructs something that looks an awful lot like an investment product. There are different risk returns, it almost starts to look like a basket of bonds or something like that. Any regulator would look at that and say, you're making investment decisions on the basis of folks whose capital you could be managing, right? So, and so moving that up to the LRT feels critical. I want to close the book on just...
Just one more point on that, if it's all right. I think it would be interesting, you know, Jim, with the Cosmos Hub, you mentioned you submitted a proposal, right, to a governance forum where everybody is kind of in one place and can see it and make improvements on it. And then, you know, when new consumer chains come forward, they submit a proposal to governance, right? And that's a single place where like all the operators and stakers can kind of see what's going on. And I think EigenLayer is going to need something like that, right? Where it's a governance forum that's purely for like new AVS proposals. And it's kind of like a, you know, a request for quote, like RFP is like, hey, we're new. We want to come in here. We don't care if it's an LRT or if you're a regular operator, you know, here's what we're looking for. Here's what the economics that we offer. Come opt in if you want to. Or it's like more out in the open, right? But it is like a consolidated place where everybody has kind of a view into what's going on. And I think that's probably one of the first like things that needs to happen here. Because LRTs, in the absence of that, are the only other versions of that where you can go to one place and, you know, engage with operators and stakers. So, sorry, that was the last thing.
The RFP process that you're outlining there is giving me this flashback to my days as a consultant. Basically, probably 50% of what we did, I was at this boutique agency, and we focused an enormous amount on procurement. When I was there, it was like 70% of the... We would do this with actually mostly like large milestones. We talk about this so many times. You know what I'm going to say. Steel, helping conglomerates purchase like hundreds of millions of dollars of steel and running these incredibly sophisticated RFP processes to break down costs and get really into the nitty gritty of the economics across every player of the value chain. Honestly, I will say an enormous area that crypto has to improve on is the sophistication of RFP processes. It's like so bad. So bad. But I want to get deeper on the LRTs, but I want to put a bookmark for folks who, if you have one sort of takeaway around, you know, what the demand side is of this marketplace is now, like ultimately, maybe to editorialize a little bit my own opinion here, it feels light, right? It feels light. Miles, you know, I've like debated back and forth about this. I think we're maybe heading into a bull market here. I'm kind of more on the side that demand will come ultimately. It always tends to. It surprises you to the upside. Like just having tried to business plan across these cycles, like I always underestimate the sheer amount of demand that will come into the market. But is it fair to say that most of the capital that's moving into EigenLayer today is chasing farming, and it's not like AVS yields here?
I wouldn't actually frame. I think the demand side for EigenLayer is actually pretty healthy. Like, look, there's ICS had two consumer chains. There's already, you know, 20 to 40 teams building on it. It's more that supply side is so absurdly, you know, overweighted that I think they're doing great in terms of the amount of adoptions of AVS. I just don't think anybody expected $11 billion of you know, economic stake locked up in EigenLayer at this point. And frankly, like, even though the demand side's coming on really well, there's not like that much spend to really make it worth, you know, from a pure yield standpoint, right? Airdrops aside, like longer term, we're going to need hundreds of AVSs to like support $11 billion. So maybe just stop depositing and we'll have like, you know, no more issues.
I want to get a sense of like the LRT part of this. So this is the liquid restaking. Miles, I'm going to put a feather in both of our caps. Like we did an episode on this like 3-4 months ago, which was, I think, a little ahead of its time, actually. Since then, there have been a whole bunch of LRTs that have moved from sort of this background thing that people assumed was coming into the spotlight, many prominent teams. And I want to get a sense of, Miles, you actually wrote something up, like a sort of a 5-page treatise here on how to look at LSTs versus LRTs. And I think a lot of these discussions, like you hear a lot of people say, actually, liquid restaking tokens are going to compete with the likes of Steeth. But I think you at least see these as very different products, and the competitive vector, or the vectors that these two types of projects are going to compete on, as being super, super different. So can you just give folks a sense of like, how do you think about LSTs from a high level? Then how does that compare to LRTs as a product?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to give like the TLDR. And so I think I'd first off say that they are going after the same market, of which is ETH holders that are looking, you know, to basically get some yield on their ETH, either by staking or by staking and restaking, while also retaining, you know, some level of liquidity on that ETH. But I think that they are very different in terms of their designs and their value prop. And I think at the end of the day, they are different products that appeal, that really solve different sort of, they really offer solutions to do two different things. So I'll say like LSTs are really homogenous by design, right? They're all doing this like slightly different ways of doing the same job, which is, you know, just securing Ethereum. They don't compete on yield, right? If they did, then Lido would not be number one. They compete, in my opinion, basically to come as close as possible to reaching parity with ETH in terms of, you know, moneyness, right? So can I go sell this if I need liquidity right away? Can I go use this in DeFi? You know, I think we'll see more and more is, can I use this as gas on L2s, right? And they have really just one asset on the balance sheet. It's ETH, right? And so they also
like issue more ETH, like they issue the staking rewards every 24 hours so that it tries to stay in parity as well.
Exactly. So they track to the price of ETH. The market pretty much knows how to price in whatever smart contract risk or say like withdrawal period, you know, dynamics. And that to me is, okay, we're trying to be internet money, especially on L2s, right? And then you look at LRTs, and to me, it's like the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of just how like heterogeneous these things are going to look in terms of the so many different elements of their design and operations, and really what is the like also the underlying, right? And so starting off with like, okay, do they just take ETH, like native ETH as collateral and stake it and then restake it? Or are they accepting this like, you know, is the assets side of the balance sheet a bunch of LSTs and ETH, right? That matters for pricing. They will all have, you know, slightly different or very different AVS restaking selections. That matters from a risk standpoint, right? They will have different ways of handling rewards. Some of them are going to actually just hold the rewards of these native staking, you know, reward tokens. So like AVS, you know, shitcoin like 1 through 10 will be on the balance sheet along with the restaked ETH, right? Some of them are going to sell that, those rewards before they, you know, get brought back into the protocol, rebalanced and compounded. And then some of them are just going to hold a whole lot of like just regular staked ETH on the balance sheet. So it's sort of like float around the ETH price, right? So it's not fully deployed. And then the last thing I think is the most hairy one is actually like the duration. And we touched on this earlier, but the duration of these restaking agreements, that's going to be really hard to support, right? When you're trying to like compete directly with Steeth. And so, you know, I think the more that like, if you were to an LRT trying to compete with Steeth, you would want to try to appeal to everybody. You would want to like accept as many types of collateral as possible. You'd want like, come up with an AVS mix that more or less is like, you know, can satisfy like the whole market in terms of risk preference. And I just think the more that you try to do these things, like the worse you actually are at any of them, right? So by accepting a bunch of, you know, LST collateral, you're not going to be able to reach the super conservative depositors that don't want like their collateral commingled with that and socializing the slashing risk with things they would never touch on their own. There's going to be people that are happy to lock up their ETH for 2 years, right? If that means higher returns, and you know, that could be like sort of a fixed income or like some sort of like longer duration product, right? But if the more you try to do that, you know, with folks that want their capital right away, the more complicated it gets, and then you could end up with like some really unhappy customers. And so what I see like the LRT side moving towards is just having a lot less network effects at like the asset level, meaning like each particular LRT will never have the sort of network effects that Steeth does, just because it's not going to be really used as an asset. Like I don't think they're going to be very good at that. They're not going to track to the price of ETH. It'd be like kind of a nightmare for like an LRT to be used as gas. Like imagine dealing with that. And so I think you could have winners at the entity level, sort of like Fidelity and BlackRock are winners at, you know, for mutual funds and have a family of different products that, you know, basically appeal to different user preferences. That's kind of where I see this going. I think the challenge is that, you know, the more assets you launch, like the more expensive it is to say like, you know, keep like enough liquidity on each one or something like that. So that's generally where, like, I think a lot of the market's kind of like missing right now, but I'd love to be wrong. So please push back on anything.
So just one thing, I mentioned that, like, you pay out the rewards every 24 hours. That's like for the Lido model, right? There's rewards bearing and then there's rewards based, like liquid staking. Some of them compound, where like one LST equals, yes, 1.x amount.
Yeah, rebasing or non-rebasing. Exactly.
Non-rebasing. Yeah. We actually invested in one LRT. So we invested in Renzo protocol. And I think the way that we thought about it was, like, number one, these can be very big, and actually it's not winner take all, right? I think what we've seen in Lido's case more or less is that it's been winner take all, right? The more you look like money, or the more you look like ETH, like the more like network effects you have, and just like the liquidity becomes deeper and deeper. And it just sort of is like us a mile ahead of everyone else. With LRTs, based on all of the sort of like factors that you just described very well, Miles, like, we're going to see these compete for very different sort of use cases and very different types of customers and users. And so I do think that, like, generally speaking, the unlock will be whether LRTs can be like used as collateral. Outside of collateral, there's like you look at Lido, you even look at STE, like, what do most people do with it? I think like 85 to 90% of it is just sitting in people's wallets. They just want the ability to like exit when they want to exit. And actually staking is just unnecessarily difficult on Ethereum L1. Like, you have to run your own validator, or you have to have over 32 ETH. And like, this just provides like a really simple solution for a lot of people who otherwise would be like not able to participate. And essentially getting diluted depending on whether it's inflationary or deflationary. For LRTs, like, I mean, we do view this as like more of a yield bearing instrument, and you're going to be able to do a lot of different things with those assets. Like, it's going to be all over the place. And like, we think that it'll be like probably like four or five, maybe like leading contenders. And we're kind of seeing that right now, I think, just in the market and like how well so many of these protocols have like been able to, like, you know, capture hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of like ETH being restaked. Doesn't hurt that there's also like incentives to do that through, like, not only are you getting eigen points, maybe those will be worth something someday, but also like these other points or these other tokens. I mean, EtherFi just, you know, launched its token, and like, I believe it's more, the fully diluted value is like more value than my value than Lido right now. So that's the world we're in. Welcome to the degen like side of things. And like, but yeah, whether that's like, whether that makes sense or not, like, I'll let other people like discuss.
Miles is shaking his head for those of you who are not following along. To put a bow on this, because I want to move on to Solana L2s as well, which is interesting. You can sort of think about Steeth. Miles and I did a whole season on liquid staking, and one of the big central questions there was, what does the market structure look like? It's a winner take, if not all, then winner take most market. And that is the money market, right? Money, commodity, bond, whatever you want to lump this new stuff that we're making here in crypto, like, that's what it's competing on. Security, liquidity, et cetera. Those are the vectors. The LRTs look much more like a mutual fund, and it's a total return type competition. So that actually has a very fragmented market structure. And so I know there are at least some very smart folks out there who disagree with this point of view. I'll call him loosely friend of the pod, John Zettler. Shout out, John, if you're listening to this. There are different views outside of this, but I tend to agree with that as well. I think a big part of it is the homogeneity of the, basically what the stakers are doing in like a staking pool like Lido, as opposed to just so different and heterogeneous in the LRT world. And, you know, Jim, to your point about, would you accept these things as collateral? Like, just think about it. If there are, you know, 15 different LRTs, different combination of operators and AVSs, how do you even underwrite that? How do you underwrite that from a collateral standpoint? It's so much easier when it comes to Steeth, right? It's hard to see it for me as well. So I'm basically agreeing with you. I want to move on and actually spend the last like 15 minutes talking about something which I think is pretty interesting and has sort of gone under the radar, but Solana L2s. There have been some rumblings about this for a little while, whether or not L2s would ever come to Solana. You know, it's kind of, as many things have, got dragged into this whole modular versus monolithic debate. But I do that. And like we were talking in our chat before, there have actually been a couple of protocols on Solana that have quietly launched or announced their intention to transition to a Solana L2, which I was pretty shocked didn't get more attention. And shout out to 0x Research, because I wouldn't have known about it unless I listen to our analysts talking about it on a podcast. But Zeta Markets is doing this, and there's another protocol called Grass. Zeta makes an enormous amount of sense to me just based on their derivatives trading platform over on Solana. But what do you guys think about this idea of Solana L2? I'm curious to get your guys' takes.
Okay, I'll go. I think it's interesting. I don't spend a ton of time in Solana land. Dougie from our team spends much more time in Solana land than I do. I think if I was going to put my so this is probably a mid take. So just like I'll accept that the trolling that will ensue. If I had to say one thing, I would say it seems like they're coming maybe at the best time or maybe the worst possible time. We're finding liquidity fragmentation is coming to an integrated blockchain near you right now. And it's happening because it's hard. Generally speaking, there's a couple of tweets about it's hard to land transactions on chain right now. For Ethereum, it's really expensive and slow, but really it was just really expensive. And I can't get my transactions through. It's not expensive on Solana, right? But it is taking longer than people expected. And people are having trouble getting bridge transactions through. People are having trouble minting NFTs. People are having crazy slippage, and having to enable that. And the Solana user base, it's accepting this, partially because maybe they just don't know any better. I think what it goes to show is that bottlenecks will exist. And as soon as bottlenecks exist, they will exist on some chain at certain points in time. And developers are not going to just sit and wait 6 to 9 to 12 months until everything gets fixed and Fire Dancer comes or someone comes to save the day. It's just not these people are trying to build applications and products that people want to use. And what it ultimately does is they're going to find workarounds quickly and more quickly than anyone anticipates. The market moves quick, right? This industry moves quick. And so those moments of what do people decide to do typically have downstream effects that honestly can influence how the ecosystem and how the network operates and is built going forward. It sounds like I said, that's why it kind of sounds like maybe the worst time for this to be all happening on Solana is just because people will start to build L2s. Now, one of the more interesting things, and we were talking about this before, was when we look at Ethereum, what was Ethereum's solution to it's too expensive, right? It's too slow. It was let's just build Ethereum on top of Ethereum. And without making it any better or optimizing on any sort of way, Ethereum equivalency was considered the holy grail. I don't think people are thinking about building generalized smart contract platforms like SVM chains on top of Solana right now. What we're seeing are application specific rollups where it's a DEX or I think what Grass is, I had to look it up, but it looks like it's some sort of data AI layer or something like that. And so what they're saying is it's not that it's a dedicated block space. Let's just ignore dedicated block space. That's one reason why maybe people would use this, but not in this case. It's actually because of maybe throughput or just reliability and being able to have transactions execute maybe even in the way or the order that you want to, and making some opinionated decisions about which transactions go first and which transactions go second are less important. So Ethereum equivalency, I think, was so what we did was we built Ethereum on top of Ethereum, and now we're talking about L3s, and it seems very stupid. I think really what we want to do more than anything is if there's application specific rollups that kind of use or work on top of Solana, that probably, I can see a world where that exists and where that makes sense. Where I get concerned is on the bridging side of things and users getting rugged because of just the things that we're talking about with slippage and users less familiar with some of these these risks that are enabled when you do slippage and you get wrecked. These users are also going to have to bridge up to L2s, and if they do that and they're don't know exactly what they're doing and the bridge is maybe a multi-sig, what happens in that scenario and who gets hurt?
Just to respond to Jim, something that you said about ultimately the reason for this, I think it looks a little unfortunate because there's a bunch of failed transactions that are happening on Solana right now, but I don't think that's what's driving this actually. One, this takes so long, right? I'm sure that this has been in the works for a while, but also actually, Miles, you were at this, but we hosted a Solana research sort of meetup and hang at our offices earlier this year. And they were actually talking about something called PROS. I'm going to share my screen here. This is a very old proposal, but it's called program rebatable account write fees. And these got proposed because we've talked on this program before how probably Solana, their fee markets are sort of broken and need an upgrade. But one of the flaws that in the fee markets of Solana currently is that it's free to just write lock any account, and you can actually do it like in an unlimited basis. So this was a proposal to essentially charge a fee to write lock an account, but you have the host of that account or the owner of that account would have the ability to rebate that fee, right? So you can punish people that are just spamming contracts, and you can actually reward users that are actually trying to interact with the account in a legitimate way. And the reason for this is like, if you think about what this really is, this is about sovereignty and economic control of the account on a general purpose L1. And to maybe draw a comparison to the idea of liquid staking in general is like liquid staking, there are a bunch of different reasons why liquid staking makes sense, and it differs based on each ecosystem. And I think for L2s, like one of the differences between Solana and Ethereum is that there are a couple of reasons why you'd want to do an L2. It's cheaper, you're moving a lot of the actual execution load off main chain, but also there's this kind of sovereignty reason. And like a huge amount of the way that, like honestly, app chains, the way that they deal with MEV and can extract rent and shift around their economics, like that's really nice. In Ethereum land, where fees are so expensive on main chain, it's been so focused on the cost aspect, right? Driving costs down. Yes. But there's really this other bucket and reason why you might want to launch an L2 and not just be a smart contract on main chain, right? And that has to do with everything that the application, like the Cosmos people just saw, you know, they were just 5 years too early, I think, in just the control over your UX and your ability to mitigate some of these like MEV economics type things. And I think that is ultimately what's going to make L2s on Solana take off and make sense. It's not going to be about cost savings. Probably for that reason, general purpose L2s on Solana make a lot less sense. But app-specific L2s on Solana, I think, makes a ton of sense. And then, Jim, to your point about learning from other ecosystems, like this was kind of the fatal flaw in the roll-up centric roadmap for ETH, is that they just didn't account for interop whatsoever. So
thank you. I guess I was actually going to bring that up. I was like, I just sincerely hope they work right on like the in-protocol.
So if you were a Solana standard builder listening to this, please, for the love of God, like think about interop. It's not like we're so early here, right, with all of these things launching. Like talk to, I think Union or Polymer are talking about IBC on Solana potentially as well. Yep. So like, go talk to these guys. Like, let's do that. PSA for Solana builders out there.
Yeah, I have a couple of quick reactions. I totally agree with you. I think the reasons across the whole space that you see activity or teams moving to L2s or moving to their own chains is either because the base layer has gotten so shitty for their users that they have to, like, that's where we see just general purpose, you know, L2s kind of make sense. Or you're like DYDX, you have the leverage, right, to do this and you take a whole user base with you because you've built a huge brand. Then the third reason is just kind of to differentiate versus peers, because you can get some feature that actually, you know, I think for Zeta is even lower latency with, in a roll-up setting. Right. And, you know, I think it would be not a bad situation at all for Solana to have, you know, instead of having general purpose L2s, keep all the general purpose stuff on L1s. And when projects have enough leverage and can take their users to an L2, that's how you kind of let them graduate to that. And it's not going to be every project, because some projects benefit more than others from composability.
Right.
And so I totally expect like super apps, you know, at some point, for the reasons that, you know, we see like app chains elsewhere and really like stretch what you can do with an app chain in terms of, you know, custom block building and even like native smart accounts, just all these levels of extra control that you have and value capture that comes with it. It will happen. And that's a good for Solana that they graduate to a Solana L2. I think what I'm super interested in is, because we haven't really seen it yet, like how, like the trade-offs that we see on Ethereum, like how bad are they in a Solana setting when you have, you know, ultra fast, like transaction speed, low cost and finality, like pretty quickly, right? Does that in itself like make these interop challenges a little less scary because you can just hop in and out of them? Or even like, could you maybe just have these be like based rollups, or like, I don't know, it could work like that. I think that maybe takes away from the value capture stamp. Yeah. I go back and forth on base rollups all the time myself, but like that's to me what I'm interested in is like, how bad is, you don't have to wait 7 days, right, for like coming down from an optimistic rollup. So all those things, miles. What do they look like? Right?
Yes.
Progressive decentralization of like decentralized applications, like ultimately leads to applications that have like large user bases creating their own like value accrual mechanism that like doesn't share as much of it with the base layer. Like Cosmos was too early. I think like Ethereum had an opportunity to maybe do L2s, and like a lot of teams just jumped on them because it was just too expensive to operate. And I think like, even for Ethereum, you know, like we were talking about before, like it looks like everybody just tried to copy the EVM. And like, I think one of the best areas of like research right now is in like super optimization and like evolving the EVM, which I mentioned before. Like David Silverman from Polygon like had a tweet, and I'm going to just like print it on a shirt and like wear it around all the conferences, which is like evolve the EVM, right? Like the roadmap of Ethereum being a rollup centric one, essentially what it says to us is like the innovation should continue at the L2 layer. Like don't rely on us for innovations, like super deep innovations on like execution any longer. You guys take the baton and run with it. And we just like really haven't seen anyone do that too much, quite honestly. They've gone for like equivalency versus like evolution, let's say. And like that is why like I'm actually really excited about like the Mega ETH team. I think they're like, they're doing something like really hard. They're like really focusing on like providing, you know, an execution layer that will ultimately be able to compete with like high throughput, like high frequency L2s or L1s, sorry, alt L1s. And like Ethereum is going to need Mega ETH essentially, is like my hot take. And if it was like so easy, like I'm just shocked that there's been billions and billions of dollars like invested in L2s. And this is where this is the state of things, like 120 transactions per second on a good day. And like, what are we doing, guys? Like you have billions of dollars, like that's the best you can do. Like Mega ETH is going to come in and just like, kind of, I think, blow the water out of a lot of these and have people look kind of silly that like, that was like what they optimized for, was like 10x improvements versus 1000x improvements.
Well, the other thing that I completely agree with you on that, Jim, the other side of that spectrum though, is I think people are going to start to question again, like what is like minimum viable sort of functionality look like for the L1, right? For so long, the design principle of ETH has been to push complexity aside. And I was just looking for the tweet. I couldn't find it, but maybe we can get it in time to put on the video for later. Vitalik actually a couple months ago posted like, I used to be very much in favor of just pushing complexity up to the rollup layer, but now I'm rethinking some of that. And actually Ethereum has to have more functionality. Like Miles, you and I have talked about this forever, but this whole like Ethereum is settlement layer. Like if all Ethereum does is settlement, I'm sorry, that's bearish. Like that is bearish. I think you're starting to see folks understand this on, that's why there's this huge push, right? From some folks for ETH to be DA and ETH to be a sequencer. It's like, hey guys, like the L1 is still this really important coordination layer and has to do more than just be this like really slow settlement layer. And I agree with you, Miles, about that point. Like, frankly, I've been sort of interested in the idea of base rollups on Solana because, yeah, you don't have 12 second block times. You have 400 millisecond block times. They want to move it to 200 millisecond block times. And then suddenly a lot of the, you know, 90% of the pain of base sequencing goes away in that world. So I think we're going to start to re-examine what the ideal role of the L1 is, assuming that every L1 is going to have L2s, and what functionality should be part of the L1 and what should be part of the layer 2s. And there are other chains out there that are building, like, frankly, I want to give like Avalanche, the way that they've handled interop across their subnets is great. And I think people don't talk at all about like the role that the L1 should play in interoperability between its chains. So
to build a rollup, or to design a roadmap that is rollup centric and not think about interoperability and how all of these things are going to interact with one another feels like a miss, like an own goal, right? Like it's, we should have been thinking a little bit more about like, what does that look like? And how does that function operationally and like in a good and seamless way?
And we're armchair quarterbacking, and there's so many priorities, right? Like, I mean, like, you know, I want to give credit where credit is due. We just got the merge. We got Dankun. This is building the plane in midair. So I'm not saying we could do better here. It's just, you know, other chains like learn.
I definitely cannot do better.
No. But I would hope that like projects, you know, in general, infra projects, whether it's Eigenlayer or like Ethereum core development, is like kind of listening to the market, seeing what like users are actually doing, and then being a little bit more opinionated, not necessarily in saying things like you have to do this, but here's a standard, right? Like we're going to enforce a few canonical standards that are just going to make everybody's lives a lot easier. You're not going to have to, you know, choose between the Connext, Wormhole, Layer Zero, you know, like all these interop standards or like something like that. You have to be very careful, like, you know, which you pick and choose, right? Because, you know, if you're overly opinionated about the wrong thing, then you're going to like, you know, you're going to lose your user base. But yeah, that's what I'd like to see a little bit more of just in general is like, I know it's all about credible neutrality and, you know, that's extremely important, but like there is a kind of a needle to thread, I think. Not that I could have done any better either, but.
Agreed. We're just humble middle of the bell curvers. Guys, unfortunately, we got to wrap it here, but this was a lot of fun. Jim, we got to have you back on the show again sometime.
Please do. Enjoyed myself. Thanks for having me, guys. Have awesome. A safe flight home, Mike.
All right. Appreciate
See you guys.
Thoughts. Hey everyone, Mike here. If you're a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring assets across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That is why we're incredibly excited to have teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole protocol. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. Click the link at the bottom of this episode to get your free NFT.